Jane Goodall has estimated that the world's great apes may be extinct in the wild within 20 years. Ophir Drury has been working to prove that prediction wrong through his group, The Last Great Ape Organization, which has been working for wildlife preservation throughout Africa and especially in the Republic of Cameroon. Mr. Drury recounts his experiences on the continent and his efforts to save apes and other wild animals in a memoir he's called The Last Great Ape. It's published by Pegasus, and I'm very pleased to welcome him to our show today on our first backstory segment. Hi.
Thank you. Hi.
So what is a greater threat to the great apes, habitat loss or people hunting them?
Well, hunting, but maybe more than hunting, because what we're talking about is wildlife crime. You see that the international illegal trade in wildlife is the third or fourth largest illegal trade in the world. I mean, we're talking about not just small poachers running around. We're talking about organized crime. We're talking about mafias. This is serious business, and that's what we are here to fight.
And the criminal activity is to take these creatures. And I mean, why would anybody want a great ape as a pet?
Well, there's
or is this
two
for
different.
Zoos?
Now, there's two different trades. One trade is in trade in the meat of great apes. You see, this meat is considered to be exclusive because it's rare. It's like caviar. Maybe let's call it the caviar of
Africa.
Have
you ever tasted it?
No, I have.
What do people tell you it tastes like?
Well, I don't think it's the matter of the taste. Just like caviar. It's the psychological effect of it. It's rare. Mm-hmm. It's a symbol status, and that's what it's about. And you see, that's one of the trades. The other trade is the pet trade, where the baby chimps, the baby gorillas are being taken for private collectors, for zoos, and so on. So these are two kinds of trades that are now endangering gorillas, chimps in the wild.
And corruption is a major problem. You call the culture of corruption in many African nations Kafkaesque. How endemic is it in regard to endangered species?
Well, if we talk about wildlife crime, the major problem and that we're trying to tackle is application of the law. Because when I came in to Cameroon, I asked myself the question, how many times the law that is there to protect this species and is there against the crime, how many times it was applied?
Are there strong laws?
Over a decade, yeah, very strong laws. And the answer was zero. Not just zero wildlife traffickers were put behind bars in Cameroon, but almost all of forest-covered Africa, all of Central and West Africa, zero wildlife prosecution. So what we're talking about is trying to get the law applied, and the real obstacle for that is no doubt corruption.
And you're right about how when you first arrived, officials in Cameroon's Ministry of Environment and Forestry would buy bushmeat as a status symbol?
Yeah, of course. Let me tell you a story from the book. When I just arrived to Cameroon, I arrived as a photojournalist, and I was trying to write about the extinction, the race towards extinction of apes. And as I came in, I was trying to find the heroes fighting for the survival of the species. And instead of that, what I found is a world of international organizations, 4x4s running around, big castles, big waste of money, but not a lot of results when you look at it. And I went out for a small town and trying to research about that, and there was chimp meat for sale and gorilla meat for sale, and they told me we have also two live ones. I said, well, what are these two live ones? And these are the survivors. These are the bushmeat orphans. These are the survivors of – they are survivors of the slaughter of their family. You see, for every baby like this, we have maybe 10 other chimps that are being killed. And they took me to the house of those poachers, and they were wealthy, well dressed, and they told me, and they showed me that this baby chimp tied in a small dirty corner with a lot of beer bottles around it, and I knew I have to do something. He was sick and about to die, and I knew I had to do something. I went to the officials you're talking about, and I said, well, let's get a law applied. There is 3 years imprisonment. Let's go and do something for it. And they were all corrupt. They just wanted money. And in fact, to cut a long story short, they just said in the end, you know, if you want a baby chimp, just give us money. We'll get you one. And I came back to this baby chimp, and I was determined to save him. And I went back there, and I put a book of law on the table, on this big, huge, nice table, and I said, 3 years imprisonment. And then I started bluffing them. I tricked them into thinking that I'm a part of a big new organization, and I say, you know what, this is my new job, to get this law applied. And I know you can bribe your way out with no problem, but that's exactly my new job. I'm here to make sure you don't bribe your way out. And then they got hysterical. And at this point, they just wanted to get rid of this baby chimps and take him. And I remember going there and tying this baby chimp from his ropes, and they treated him like a rat. And in fact, he was acting like a rat because his emotional world was locked out, and they didn't see that. And I remember untying him. Everybody thought he would run away. I held my hands out, and he just climbed up, gave me a very big hug, and from that moment, he was transformed from a rat back to you, to a baby with emotional needs. And from that time, this hug was permanent. It was just there, and he was adopting me as his mother and father. And that's how, you know, that's how I stayed in Cameroon, because I had to stay there and take care of this baby chimp named Future, because I wanted to give a future for him. He can outlive me, and that's how I stayed. I had to.
Well, chimps, the apes in general, live in family groups, don't they? So what happens to the psychology of an orphaned baby who no longer has a mother, father, or siblings?
Well, many of these babies that we ended up rescuing and passed time with me, and they are traumatized. I mean, this baby chimp was on me all the time. So imagine that even when I sleep, he holds me. And you can feel that he has nightmares in the night. His eyeballs are running. He wakes up, and he needs comfort. So he keeps on sucking my body and giving me hickeys. These are the kind of things that they need. So you could see that these are traumatized babies. They have those needs, and what they need is a lot of attention, a lot of love, and at one point being integrated back into that family. So that baby chimp Future, after spending time with me and getting that love and attention, we try to integrate him to a larger family of chimps where he belongs. And
so those babies are taken when they kill the other members of their group?
Yeah, basically, if you can imagine when a poacher comes and has the order for chimps, he goes and he's trying to kill a few chimps in a group, and the others are trying to protect those that are killed and so on. And you can imagine that there are several of them are getting killed. A baby chimp is totally dependent on the mother up to 3 or 5 years old. So what they do is that the baby chimps are just clinging to the body of the mother, crying, totally helpless, just waiting for the poachers to lift them up. And a poacher can hold such a baby in the hand and weighs and say, well, wait a second, this is not a lot of meat. Maybe I can sell him for the meat and kill him here, or maybe I can try my luck in the pet trade, and that's where they get lucky, and maybe we can save them at one point.
And it is estimated that for every live ape outside the jungle, 9 others have been shot in the hunt. And they've been shot for the meat, or does it just have to be a violent process because that's the only way you can get them?
Well, it's two trades that are running in parallel. They are interconnected, the pet trade and the trade for meat, but there's no real one. It's not the cause of the other. But let's take this as an example. Just 2 weeks ago, I was in Guinea-Conakry where we started wildlife law enforcement in a country that has never had an arrest of a wildlife trafficker from independence. And there we have a trafficker that is in charge of...
But it doesn't matter which government is, because they do have changes of government. It doesn't matter which government is in control. They just, this is something that everyone looks the other way about?
The corruption stays the same. Corruption stays more or less the same. The conditions that are really the underlying causes for this are all the same. And in a country like Guinea, I just wanted to give this example that one trafficker was in charge in exporting 100 chimps in the last 2 years. Now, if you make your extrapolation of what the calculation you just given, we're talking about 1,000 killed chimps just for one trafficker. And our job is to try to run these undercover investigations and find those big traffickers and get them behind bars.
My guest is Ophir Drori, who's written with David MacDonald, The Last Great Ape, A Journey Through Africa and a Fight for the Heart of the Continent. It's published by Pegasus. So you set up sting operations to stop these people from engaging in this traffic?
Yeah, we built the concept of a wildlife law enforcement NGO, which basically starts with a ring of spies or undercover investigators, and their role is to infiltrate this criminal world of the trade and try to get the big guns, the big guys, and get evidence behind them. And after that, we have an operations unit where we run in the field. I'm there. We're all there, making sure that those sting operations run smoothly and we fight corruption through these operations.
Now, do you enjoy local support, or do most of the people think that there's nothing wrong with trading in apes?
Well, what we're talking about is activism. What we're trying to build in Africa is that sense of activism. So we're not working with people. People are not working for me. They're basically working with us, and we're trying to find and foster activists and trying to make sure that the same way that I'm passionate towards the fight against wildlife crime, we have a large group of people, and they do that with conviction, not as a job, but as a mission.
Well, since there's a lot of money to be made, and we're talking about crime, are you ever in danger?
Well, yes, we have life threats all the time, physical and legal and political. I'll give you an example of where we started in a new country, Congo. I was arriving there. I'm just in the country for just a few days, and we tried to bring about the first wildlife prosecution in the country. And my investigator, a French investigator, is trying to get the biggest dealers there so we can actually target them. And he tells me, "I got you the big fish. Maybe it's too big for you." And, you know, when we run investigation and we get the guy arrested in a good sting operation, and we get him to the station, and then the arresting officer comes to me and say, "Ophir, you don't know who we arrested. We arrested a very special man." And in fact, that guy was a father of, a leader of a rebel faction and the Cobras, you know. And these are guys who are still armed and dangerous, and everybody stopped working because everybody was thinking, well, maybe now we're going to have some guys coming in for a shootout to get this guy released. But then, when we get this guy, and I insisted that we do that, and we keep him behind bars, and when we transfer him 2 days after to jail to be transferred to jail, his family is there, and that rebel leader is there. You know, it's twice my size. The guy
with a gun.
He's twice my size. The guy is having a French beard. He's khaki suit, and the guy is looking at me and eyeing me, and I'm there, and everything is finished, and I'm there alone. In the hall, I'm in one side, he's on the other, and to get out, I have to pass near him. And as I pass near him, he just blocks my way, and he looks at me, and in a very cold and chilling voice, low voice, tells me, "You don't know this country. You should be careful." And what I did is I took my card out, and I gave it to him, and said, "This is my name, this is what I do, and this is where you can get me." And I walked out of there, of course, with shaking legs, you know, but that's what it's all about. We have these threats all the time, and with this kind
of
attitude.
Did he wind up going to jail?
What?
Did you wind up getting the man convicted?
We managed to get the man convicted.
Now,
yes.
Where is the UN and the other NGOs in all of this?
Well, we are very critical of the larger aid machine and the larger NGO machine. We think that, I mean, we highlighted a failure when I talked about zero wildlife prosecutions for decades. Then we highlight a failure that is not just failure of African governments. This is failure of all these big conservation organizations and anybody else out there that was taking taxpayers' dollars, pretending to do something about it. And we're very critical about that. And most of our work is actually trying to embarrass the bigger machine and say, well, you need to change because you need results. And what we do in these countries is get one wildlife trafficker behind bars per week, so the results speak for themselves. And it's not about money. It's about activism. It's about determination. It's about a courage to do that.
In your book, you describe your travels to the around the continent, noting that you've contracted malaria around 40 times. You've been charged by hyenas. You've been forced to eat algae to survive. You barely survived a bus accident. And yet you go back.
Yeah, you see, all these adventures and misadventures, they are the adventures that shape me. And a lot of these encounters were encounters with this magical world, whether this is, you know, opening my tent to a herd of elephants, or whether it is drinking blood in African ceremonies to be accepted as one of the tribe. This is like this magical world that I fell in love with. And in this my journey, I met a lot of interesting people. I'll give you one example from the book. I'm finishing a journey of 600 kilometers across the bush. It's all over Kenya. I have 2 months of living with the tribe, surviving the bush, arriving to... I started with my camel, which we had a dispute on the way. He went one way, I went another way. And I end up in a very, very remote area, Lake Turkana, in towards the border with Ethiopia. And I see those communities which are broken because of years of war, years of famine and hunger. And I see that and I try to understand why is this happening. And all of a sudden, after a while, I get to another community, and this community is thriving. This is the exact kind of villages which I stayed in for years, communities that immediately you run into their territories. You are a part of the family. You are accepted. You are, and they have this interdependence and care. And when I went there, I asked myself, why? What made that difference? And I find him, his name was Father Albert, jumping up and down with naked Turkana grandmothers, not really the kind of Catholic priest you'd want to imagine in a bush church, but more like Jim Morrison. And this guy, and I said, I want to stay here. I want to do things like you do. I want to make a difference. And instead, he challenged me, sitting there, guitar on the background, lighting a cigarette, and he's saying, find your place where you can dig and a plant can grow. And this was starting my search for meaning and trying to make a difference.
Ophir Drury's book, written with the help of David MacDonald, is called The Last Great Ape, A Journey Through Africa and a Fight for the Heart of the Continent. It's published by Pegasus. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you. Thank you, Leonard.